Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. You've been told time and again, we all have been told time and again, that we need to have an emergency fund. This is what you turn to in case life throws you a financial curveball. But today, we're talking about a different approach, Ed Rempel is a fee-for-service financial planner and tax accountant and creator of the Unconventional Wisdom blog. He's here to talk about some unconventional wisdom and why he thinks you need an emergency plan instead of an emergency fund. And if you want to level up in your career but don't know where to begin, sometimes some extra and outside perspective can really help the whole process. Career counselors can do just that. Taylor Urquhart is a director at Indeed Canada. He takes us through how career counseling works. Then, does high inflation have you canceling all your plans and hibernating at home to save you money? This may cause something called inflation isolation. Carol Newbery Mitchell, Senior Vice President at MNP Debt, tells us more about what causes it and how to cope. Plus, how to donate money effectively. Craig Switson, Portfolio Manager at Lexicon Financial Group at Raymond James Investment Council, has some strategies for making charitable donations go as far as possible. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. How many of you have heard that you need to have, you must have an emergency fund? Well, I'll give you a hint. Everyone has heard this because this has been like personal finance 101 for ages. How many of you actually have one? And I think we'll hear crickets, because while it is one of those pieces of advice that is almost universally distributed, not a lot of people have an emergency fund in that way. And maybe that's okay. Maybe you're not missing out. My next guest would argue that instead of having an emergency fund per se, what you really need is an emergency plan. Ed Rempel is a fee-for-service financial planner and tax accountant. He also writes the Unconventional Wisdom blog. Hello there, Ed.
Hello there, Bruce. How are you?
Well, this is unconventional wisdom here, because everybody's, emergency fund. You say we don't necessarily need an emergency fund. We need an emergency plan instead. Why do you make that argument?
Yes, that's exactly true. So what we need is we need to be able to access some money in case you have an emergency for which you don't have time to save up. And it could be a savings account, but it could also be a credit line. It could be investments. You need to have a plan of, if and when you need money for an emergency, where do you get it from?
And really, how do you define that word? Because I think from my perspective, there's an oversimplification and people lump all sorts of things under this emergency umbrella that I'd say that's actually not an emergency. Yeah. It's a lumpy expense. It's one that doesn't come every single month. But given that you own a house, it's kind of predictable that at some point you're going to need a new furnace.
Yes, exactly. Some of those things you can really predict, although you really don't know when. I find people sometimes use it just for, I have an emergency. I feel like I want a new car. Well,
right.
That's not an emergency. An emergency is you don't have time to save up. It's completely unexpected. And you know what? Like, you still have to decide how much it is. There's a rule of thumb. It should be 3 to 6 months expenses. But, for you, just think through what is the worst thing that could happen. For most people, it's losing their job. So let's say you lose your job and then it takes you quite a while to find another job. And, so EI doesn't fully cover you. And, so think of how much money you might need for that. And like you say, it could be a home repair. It could be a car repair. It could be family needs money. But kind of think of, what do you think is the biggest unexpected expense that I might get? And then you need to access the money somewhere.
You're pointing to something that I think is really important to address at the outset here, and that is people's circumstances are so different. If you were a single, the sole breadwinner in your family, losing your job is much more dramatic than if you're a two-income household in which your income may be half of what the primary breadwinner is. You lose your job. It's not fun. It's not great. Things will change, but it's not as cataclysmic if you were a single parent and sole income earner. Exactly. How do you think broadly about your very personal circumstances?
Yeah, I call it the emergency number. Like, what is the number you need? And, you know, I think usually when we're planning for an emergency plan, it is for a couple. And you're right, very often one makes a lot more than the other. So if the high income person loses their job, it's a bigger cash problem than if the low income person loses their job, you know, the budget might be fine, you know, but you could still, you know, but it could still be the other one. So you still need an emergency fund or an emergency plan based on whoever it is. But, you know, exactly like you were saying, like a lot of people have been told, you need to save one up. So I see people, you know, younger people saving, and it's like years go by and they're trying to save $30,000 in a savings account and they can't get there. And then they're tempted to spend it and years are going by and they haven't started any long-term savings yet. And it's to me a real mess. And so
yeah, because I think what you're pointing to there is the trade-off that they're making by putting 30 grand away into a savings account with not much return. It's often at the expense of something. It could be the expense at the expense of retirement savings. It could be at the expense, this is part makes me crazy, at the expense of paying down high interest debt.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Well, I mean, a lot of times they try to pay off their credit cards, but then they're tempted to run them up. And then they try to save. And, you know, 10 years go by and they've got nothing for their retirement plan yet. Right.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, still struggling with those two. Like, okay, well, you gotta start on the retirement plan. And I can tell you from like, because we've done like comprehensive financial plans for literally thousands of people. And, you know, the biggest piece of it is always the retirement plan. And you know what? To retire the way you want, the good news and bad news is the bad news is it probably takes a lot more money to retire the way you want than you think. The good news is if you make a plan, you can get there more easily than you think, but it's a big number. So you can't just keep putting it off and just fighting with the emergency fund. You gotta put it away.
Your choice of the word plan and the phrase emergency plan feels a lot more holistic than just the emergency fund piece. What else would you put under that category, an emergency plan?
Well, I think, like I said, it could be a fund. It could be a credit line that you have access to. It could be investments. You know, the most thing, what we do most commonly for the bulk of our clients is a credit line. We set up an unsecured credit line for enough that would cover for whatever they need. We tell them, like, this is a credit line over here. You know, it's a little bit high interest rate, but reasonable. So if you have to use it for a short period of time, and the intention is not to use it, and then don't use it. Like, the idea is it just sits there kind of forever. You know, so the credit line is your emergency plan. Now we're going to take that money you were going to put in the fund, and we're going to invest all of it for your retirement. And so the big thing is you don't have, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 sitting around at 2 or 3% instead of making 10% in the stock market for the next 30 or 40 years. It's a huge difference. You know, that can be $250,000 that you've lost in over 30 years by having all that money sitting around at a low return.
What's the phrase? People are their own worst enemies sometimes. So you get that line of credit. If it's secured against real estate, it could be a pretty significant amount. How do you mitigate the risk that people will spend and increase the balance on that line of credit?
For us, we have to get to know the clients. And I think most people that come to us, I guess, I think are a bit more, they actually are paying for a financial plan up front. They're more generally more responsible people. But some people, I know, are just, they can't have a credit line. They'd be tempted to spend it all the time. Well, then, you know, because we've had the odd client like that. If they have a credit line, they'll just run it up and max it. And if we refinance it for them so to free it up, they run it up again. Okay, well, yeah. then, that plan doesn't work for you. It does work for most people, but it doesn't work for you. And that thing is, some of those people, even the savings plan won't work either because they're just going to use it up. If whatever is available, you always spend. Well, then, I don't know, maybe just forget it and just take your chances because you have to start the long-term savings somewhere. And you're less likely to tap an ERSP.
One of the other realities that people need to consider, I think, in their emergency planning is health issues. One scenario would be disability. Another horrendous scenario would be death. How do you think about disability insurance, critical insurance, life insurance, and the estate plan as you think more broadly about that whole emergency plan?
Yeah, so I think of those as separate from the emergency plan. Like, the emergency plan is I need money short term. And usually we look at, you know, death and disability as separate issues, you know. So especially you're a couple, you've got someone that's dependent on you financially. If you die, it's a problem. So let's figure out how much money would it take for that, for your partner to live the same life and have the same retirement goal and other life goals. How much would you need? And let's get that much life insurance. And a lot of people think it's just enough to pay the mortgage off, but usually it's quite a bit more than that if you, you know, and you can get that pretty cheaply. And disability is the most important insurance to have because, what is it? I think the stat is 1 out of 3 Canadians are disabled for a period of time during their working career. It's usually sickness related. And on average, they're off like 2 years. So you think if you get sick and can't work for 2 years, and you get a heart attack or cancer and you're off work for 2 years.
Yeah.
Well, that's if you don't have disability insurance, that's a problem. A lot of employers have it. But those two, I think, are really critical separate pieces, separate from the emergency plan.
One last question on the funding of these unexpected expenses that I wouldn't call emergencies, because as I say, if you own a house, you should know that at some point your roof's going to leak or your toilet's going to back up or something like that. Do you advise people to have an automatic withdrawal out of their bank account on a regular basis to build up that buffer? Is that a world, knowing that it's you're not going to save 3 to 6 months of income, but you are knowing as a homeowner, just as an example, you're going to spend a couple of grand on your house. There's just no way of avoiding it over the course of a year.
Yeah, like it's we've had a similar situation with a car. People think, okay, I'm going to buy a car for a few years. Should I just start saving every month for it? Or wait till the end. And you know what? That sounds like a smart thing to do. I just find most of the time you're actually better off, I don't know, just not doing that. That's one good solid way to do it. But a lot of times we just like focus on the long-term plan, have your money available. And then so the extra money that you would have saved, you know, maybe pay your mortgage down that much faster. So you get extra, so you're making a bit more headway. And then if you use this unsecured credit line for some emergency, what you do is you try to pay it off, but if you can't, when your mortgage comes due, you roll it into your mortgage. Now you refinance it at the lowest rate and you keep focusing on paying your mortgage and saving for your retirement. And that way all your money is working much harder for you than if it's, you know, in a low return credit line savings account.
It seems like, as we've had this conversation, the biggest benefit here to this distinction between an emergency fund and emergency plan is that the plan feels doable. And we want people to have something that's doable. Because that whole 6 month fantasy of saving 6 months of income for most people in these times just feels like a pipe dream.
Life is so expensive now anyway. It's just so hard for people to do it. So yeah, emergency plan, you know, it works. It's doable. And also you're using your money efficiently, you know, effectively. So that's the biggest thing.
Really helpful stuff, Ed. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
All right. So glad to be on here again, Bruce.
Ed Rempel is a fee-for-service financial planner, tax accountant, and also writes the Unconventional Wisdom blog. We're here to talk about the difference between having one of those traditional emergency funds and perhaps a more holistic view of an emergency plan. Coming up next on Moolala, want to jumpstart your career? You may want to consider some career coaching. Taylor Urquhart from Indeed Canada is here to take us through some of the things you might learn if you engage with a career coach and talk a bit about the benefits. And later, we'll speak with Craig Swiston, portfolio manager at Lexicon Financial Group. He's got some strategies for donating your money to charity more effectively. If you want to ensure that you never miss an episode of Moolala, come on, who doesn't? Head on over to moolala.ca. You can listen to past episodes there. You can also go to the podcast platforms, any of the ones that you would download podcasts from, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Prime, Spotify, whatever. And so you can listen to the show, but you also can subscribe. So future episodes just arrive right on your device. And while you're there, bonus good karma points for leaving a review. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. There are two main levers when it comes to getting a better handle on your money. There is, of course, cutting expenses. We talk all about cutting expenses, how to do that. But the other, which we talk less about, is increasing income. So if you can take expenses down and take income up, you can hopefully increase your surplus in order to pay down debt, save for retirement, save for travel, invest more money, all those sorts of things. So how do you go about improving your income? Well, it comes back to, you know, questions of being effective in your job and continuing to pursue roles that may allow you to increase your income over the course of time. Taylor Urquhart is the head of the Indeed Job Squad in Canada, and he joins us now to talk a bit more about career coaching. Hello there.
Hello, hello. How are you doing?
I love that phrase, the job squad. It's like, is there like a 1-800 number that I can call and get the Indeed job squad to come to my house and, I don't know, make me more handsome for my next Zoom job interview? What is exactly involved for the job squad?
So the job squad partners with our ESG or environmental social governance group. And essentially, we partner with a lot of community organizations to help job seekers who are facing barriers find their next role. So essentially, anyone who might have a non-traditional challenge in being able to land their next job and needs a little bit of guidance as to next steps, we try and partner with those organizations to be able to create some more synergies for them.
And you know, the phrase that people may well have heard about is a career coach. When you think about career coaching, how would you identify what that actually means? What are they coaching a human in?
Essentially identifying their own strengths and talents and really making sure they're able to market themselves in the best way possible. A lot of what people do when they're applying for their next job is when you're interviewing, you're essentially selling yourself. And for a lot of people, it's a new concept. And sometimes a little bit of guidance can be needed to be able to tailor their resume and make sure that all of the great skills and assets that they possess are being portrayed in the best light possible.
These days, there are services such as Indeed that make it both way simpler to apply for jobs, feels like you do it in one click, and also it seems like it's harder to get the job because suddenly now there's like 1,000 applicants, where before, when there was a lot of work to do, the pool might be a little smaller. Tell us more about the latest and greatest on resumes. What are people, is it longer? Is it shorter? Is it, what are some things that people should think about when it comes to developing the most effective resumes?
I think one of the most important things to consider when you're crafting a resume is being succinct, while also being detailed enough that you capture the attention of whoever it is who's scanning through and reading that resume. One of the biggest pieces of advice that I give people is when you're applying for a particular kind of job, you almost feel like you have deja vu. Reading through all these job descriptions, you find a lot of similarities for the same title or the same kind of role. And those are things that you really want to focus on in your own resume, that kind of the meat of the resume, that 75% that you see repeated in each job description. You want to make sure that you're encapsulating that in your own skill set and your own performance and the way that you are showcasing yourself, so that whether it's the recruiter or the HR manager or whoever it is who's scanning through your resume sees those similarities as well and hopefully moves you into a phone screen or into the next step in the interview process.
that resume is a key part of the tool to build this sort of narrative for your candidacy. I'm a journalist by background. Facts really matter to me. What caution would you provide to job applicants in terms of just how flowery they might become in telling the narrative about their work history?
I think it's really important to not oversell yourself because it's probably only going to come back to bite you in the end. I think that it's really important that you articulate correctly the skills that you have and your level of competency with those skills, because eventually it will come out, you know, how successful you are at a particular task or what your true skill set is. And the best thing you can do is make sure that you're aligning that and setting the right expectation right out of the gate.
So your resume was sufficient to get you that first interview. Awesome. Fantastic. How do you coach people to prepare for that, that first interview? What are the key things they need to do to prep?
I think one of the big things is to research the employer. Employers love when you know a little bit about them. You may have applied to quite a number of jobs. However, when you're in an interview with that particular employer, it's important that you can pull out some little facts or tidbits about that company, why you want to work there, perhaps why their, you know, unique mission really speaks to you. If they've been involved in any sort of community work that you're also passionate about, I also think that's something fantastic to be able to bring up, because that's really going to help differentiate you from some other candidates who are just showing up to the interview, not necessarily knowing anything about the role itself, the company, or even the hiring manager. So doing a little bit of homework beforehand, using something like Indeed's company pages, where you can read reviews, find information about, you know, what the employer is doing in the community, the kind of roles that they're hiring for, what people think of the CEO and the management there. You can relay all of that information back in your interview and really stand out as a top candidate.
One of the big categories of questions are behavioral questions. So give me an example of a time when you demonstrated leadership, those kinds of things, usually said in an accent like that, I'm sure. How does one prepare for those types of questions, knowing that there's not like 80,000 of those? There's maybe 10 you need to prepare for at max.
I think when you're talking about behavioral questions, try and think a step ahead if you can to make your answer a little bit more cohesive. Think about perhaps the why that they're asking you this question and how it could potentially relate to the job, or perhaps to other experiences that you already possess or ways that you've navigated different aspects of your career, whether that's a challenge, whether that's a success that you've had, and kind of try and craft a narrative to be able to link those two together. That shows a bit of foresight and also shows how you're able to highlight your skills and bring them back to a wide variety of different behavioral things.
The best piece of advice I got there was years ago, the CAR model, context, action, result. And I was told to like put it on a piece of paper in advance. Do you recommend people bring paper to job interviews? I mean, so many are on Zoom, they wouldn't have any idea if you had a piece of paper in front of you.
I think my one hesitation with someone bringing paper is it's really easy for a lot of people to kind of keep their head down and look like they're reading a canned response, essentially. And that's never ideal. Employers want to get to know you. They want to see the true version of yourself, not a perfectly edited version. And you never necessarily know what question they're going to ask. And I find that people often stumble to be able to adapt, let's say, what they wrote on paper and weave in some new concepts that naturally came up through the interview process. So it can leave the employer feeling that perhaps you're a bit rigid and that you need a lot of prep time. And it's better to think on your feet if you can.
Situational questions is another like broad category of questions. How do you prepare for those? I have always found that to be probably the most stressful part of a job interview.
I think it kind of ties back to some of the things I was talking about with the behavioral example as well, but really taking into account, you know, perhaps the why behind it. Like, what's the real reason that you think the employer is asking this? Is this something that comes up frequently in this job? Are they looking for someone who has, you know, experience with dealing with conflict, as an example, or someone who has, you know, perhaps a lot of experience in being able to close a sale quickly and effectively, whatever it might be. and really using the examples that you can think of, ideally from some of your more recent, either your most current role or the role before that, being able to show some continuity between the work that you've done and the work that you're hoping to do at this new employer goes a long way.
I'm on the hiring side a lot. We think a lot about the questions we ask. And then we open the floor to the candidate to find out what they want to ask from us. I don't know if we've ever hired someone who wasn't ready with some really interesting and insightful questions. And I'm not sure why that's such an important thing, but it is for us. Maybe it goes back to your research point earlier. What sort of questions should a candidate prepare when the baton is passed and they say, what do you want to know? What do you want to know from us?
I think it's really good for anything that came up in the interview that perhaps isn't necessarily premeditated that you can weave in there. I think that shows a lot of proactivity and how you're thinking about the role and how that relates to the questions that you were asked in the interview process. I also think questions around the research that you've done, if there's something that came up that sat really well with you or that you were really thrilled to find out about the employer, asking more information about that, asking whether it's the recruiter or the hiring manager, you know, what they love about their job and what makes this workplace unique and, you know, why you should work there yourself is always great as well. As a job seeker, you have a lot of opportunity available to you. And the market, especially now, has shifted a little bit in terms of people are being more particular about where they choose to apply. And they want to find out more details about the employer. So interviews are not a one-way street. It has to be a mutually agreeable contract, essentially, for you to start working there. It's supposed to be beneficial for both parties. And this is your real opportunity to be able to ask any burning questions that you may have about that particular employer.
Let's say you feel like, yes, I hit it out of the park. I did everything I had hoped to do in that interview. What should a job seeker do afterwards? Do you send a cake? Do you send flowers? Do you send a pizza? Do you send a handwritten note? What's best practice these days?
I really do think that it's great to follow up, especially after a few days, thanking whether it's your interviewer or whoever the hiring manager is that you chatted with, thanking them for their time, some of the things that came up in the interview that you were very excited about. It's always nice to kind of close the loop and ask for like next steps. I think it shows a level of proactivity. But I also think it's really important to give a little bit of time. I wouldn't send it out like a second after the interview has completed. Give them, let's say, 48 hours to kind of sit, think about it, compare you to some of the other candidates. And then it's a nice little reminder about the interview that you had and bringing yourself back up to the forefront after that.
Really helpful stuff. Taylor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Taylor Urquhart is the head of the Indeed Job Squad in Canada, and he was here to talk a bit about some of the things you might want to keep in mind if you're on the verge of a job search yourself. Coming up later, how to give to charity more effectively. Craig Swiston is portfolio manager at Lexicon Financial Group, and he's got some tips. But first, is the high cost of living impacting your mental health? You may be experiencing something called inflation isolation. Carol Newbury Mitchell from MNP Debt is here to talk about it. Another thing we're talking about, book clubs. Are you in a book club? If you haven't yet, you really should use your book club as an opportunity to read about money together. I know, super fun, right? I have written not one, but two books about money, about personal finance. The first one is called The Moolah La Guide. Oh no, the first one, oh my gosh, the second one's called The Moolah La Guide to Rocking Your RSP. The first one is called Moolah La, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. And in the back of that book is a guide for your book club. So you can get it online, you can do a Kindle version, get it from the library, but bring a money book, whether it's mine or David Chilton's, to your book club.
Hi, it's me. Your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com. We all believe in the possibilities of tomorrow. And at Easy Financial, we're here to help you every step of the way. If the banks aren't an option, we can help get you approved for a loan in as little as 10 minutes. And with our personal, home equity, and auto loans, you can choose the loan that's right for you, so you can start rebuilding your credit for a better tomorrow. Apply today without affecting your credit score at easyfinancial.com or at over 400 locations and find out how much you can qualify for. Easy Financial. Better tomorrows.
We could talk all day, every day, about inflation. Prices are up almost everywhere you look, and that's had many consequences for people. Certainly in terms of your family income statement, it has affected how you spend. It has affected how you feel about how you spend. And for some people, it has affected how you live in the world, how you socialize. There is a new phrase out there called inflation isolation. And we're going to talk a bit about this today. Carol Newbury Mitchell is a licensed insolvency trustee at MNP Debt. Her firm did a big survey on this. I don't know if you coined the phrase, Carol, but I like the phrase. Welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you very much for having me. I'd love to take credit for it, but I can't say for certain that it was us.
No, you can't, but that's okay, because I think it's not something that we've talked about. And so I'd love first how you would define the phrase inflation isolation.
Right. I think the way we look at it is it's really this, what we see is people pulling back from social activities, from spending time with family and friends. And it's stemming from this double whammy of having soaring living expenses due to inflation. And then because of the increased interest costs and the increased debt that people are carrying, generally speaking, the increased cost to their servicing their debt. So it's like the two things are coming together and it's really affecting how people are behaving.
As a polar extrovert, it was everything I could do to hold it together during the pandemic when we couldn't socialize, to see that some people are making tough choices about socializing because of their financials just makes my heart weep because it's such an important part of my my life. Talk a bit more about where that shows up in specifics. Is it, geez, I can't afford to go to a restaurant, or geez, I can't even afford to hop in my car on a weekend and go see my parents because they live 2 hours away?
I think it's all of those things. I think it's people making really tough choices when they're invited out for dinner with their friends and they say, no, I can't go because literally I don't have any credit left on my credit card and I don't have the cash in the bank. I think it's, and if you look at who that may affect the most, you know, single people, younger people who maybe don't have as much income and don't live with other people, and the people that should be out there socializing the most, you know, it may affect them to a higher degree than it may affect other portions of the population. But, you know, the idea of pulling back and feeling emotional, and social consequences of dealing with debt and dealing with, you know, unaffordable living expenses is not really something new, I would say, that we see so much, especially in our world, of regularly dealing with people who are in financial challenges. But I think what we're seeing right now is just like a massive increase in all of those feelings. And that's what the poll showed.
Yeah. And, you know, when I'm looking at some of the specifics, this is an Ipsos poll, 34% of Canadians paying more in monthly debt payments. 45% say they don't believe they're going to be able to cover living expenses in the next year. You've been in this area for a while. How do you put these results, these survey results, in context from what you would have been thinking about or hearing about, call it 5 years ago, pre-pandemic?
Right. I think it's about what I think about is getting the message out there to people about what you can do. When you listen to all the survey results, it can be really kind of depressing. The reality is that there's a lot of help out there. So I think turning the focus a little bit more from despair and anxiety about, you know, the future, like you mentioned, one of the stats about feeling uncertain about being able to pay their bills in 12 months. Hopefully trying to turn the conversation to, okay, so what we can do about it. If we're one of those people that's feeling stuck, that's feeling anxious, is withdrawing because they can't afford to go out or they can't afford to have people over. I mean, that's even an issue now because of the cost of groceries. You know, what can I do? And I think there's, you know, three main things. Get help, you know, especially if you are feeling like you are a person that doesn't understand how this is all affecting your everyday life. Getting professional advice from an expert that deals with money management, that deals with debt challenges, makes you more able to make really good decisions about how you're going to move forward. Knowing your options. Again, talking to a professional. The internet can only give you very general information, right?
Yeah. Or some very specific bad information. Right. Sometimes it can be very specific and wrong.
And wrong and bad. Yeah. But when you talk to someone, you will get information about your specific financial circumstances and what options are available for you as an individual based on your specific facts. And three, don't wait. Don't wait. It's probably, you know, the biggest thing I hear from people. I wish I called you a year ago. I wish I dealt with this 5 years ago. I've been dealing with harassing collection calls. I've been dealing with, you know, they're calling my employer, they're calling my family. I've been dealing with garnishments. And you don't have to. Most of the advice that from, you know, reputable organizations and from licensed insolvency trustees is there's always the availability of a free consultation. And so get out there and get help.
One of the conversations you as a licensed insolvency trustee would deal with and us as nonprofit credit counselors try and navigate with people is how to think about that budget in a way that doesn't completely eliminate all joy. And for some people, socializing does provide joy. They need to build in something because otherwise any plan that they make is just not going to be sustainable over time. So how do you help them think through what really are the things that they need to keep their mental health afloat?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that comes down to, again, getting personalized advice, because when you are speaking to someone one-on-one, they're going to ask you those questions. So we always go through a budget. So we look at the top line, obviously what your income is, and then we go through all of your expenses. And like you said, there's some that you're not going to be able to move around. You're not going to be able to get rid of the rent. You're not going to be able to get rid of the hydro. But when you get into more of the discretionary items, I think really talking through and thinking about, if you're doing this yourself, what are those things that bring you joy? You know, maybe for some people, being home a lot isn't such a big deal, but they want to have their Netflix and they want to have their Disney Plus, and that's going to bring them a bit of joy. For other people, they'd say, you know, I'd rather be out more. And so thinking ahead about things like transportation costs associated with being out more, you know, a little bit more in the, you know, dining out fund, things like that. So really getting people to think about every single line item in their budget. And like you said, having it be realistic, or else you're setting yourself up for failure.
How do you ensure that the assessment of that budget is sufficiently forward-looking? And I say that given the mortgage renewals that we know are going to occur over the course of the next 12 to 24 months, where folks who'd locked in at this extraordinary fixed rate of interest are going to have the shocking awakening that that rate will not be offered to them in the future. So they've got a budget that can sort of kind of work now, but when they renew that mortgage, their budget's really not going to work as currently constructed.
Right. That's a really good point. And I think we are starting to see that. I even talk here, you know, talk amongst colleagues and friends of mine about the fear of that 2025 renewal or whatever it is. And I think it's a challenge for sure, because we can't see the future. But again, I think realistically looking at what's going to happen with your income, looking at those line by line expenses and how they're expected to change, big life changes in your life. Are you going to have a child moving out? Are you going to have a child moving in? Are you going to be no longer funding university expenses? Really trying to look out. I think you kind of have to separate it into chunks. You can't bite it off all at once. You know, short term, midterm, longer term, we're probably not talking about in this conversation. But, you know, separating out so it's not so overwhelming. You don't have to figure it out all at once. You just got to get to that like midterm mark and then reevaluate. And I think that's something that's important too, is not just sitting down doing it once and never looking at it again.
People have a particular framework for how they spend and a concept of what it is to live a life worth living. When people are dealing with debt they can't manage, a lot of that has to shift and change. It needs to be reframed. They need to think about things differently. What are some tips you would offer, coming back to our original topic here on inflation isolation, of how you can still have those relationships? They just don't necessarily revolve around a restaurant or travel.
I think one of the things we see is that people often don't share that they are struggling financially because they have a fear of judgment. They have a fear of feelings of shame and things like that that go along with struggling with financial difficulties. But I think that if you can pick a couple people in your life that you know that you can trust, that you know that you feel like you can open up to and there won't be judgment, that if you confide in them, and then they understand your situation, and then they're not going to be inviting you out for that fancy restaurant dinner. They're going to, or if they're, you know, putting together dinner plans, they're going to pick a restaurant that's not going to break the budget. I really think that, again, I guess it goes along with one of my earlier points, which is getting help. And so getting help can be from professionals, but it can also be for reaching out a little bit to, again, someone you feel comfortable with. You're not going to probably tell everybody, all your friends and acquaintances, but a few people that are important to you. And that will make you, I think, feel more connected, make you feel like you still have options for, like you said, living your life and still having some socialization.
Carol, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Carol Newbury-Mitchell is a licensed insolvency trustee at MNP Debt. And we're here to talk about some findings from a recent survey that they conducted with Ipsos on how Canadians are feeling these days. And also this idea of inflation isolation. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, giving to charity more effectively. Craig Switson is portfolio manager at Lexicon Financial Group. He shares some strategies to help narrow the giving gap. And get inspired to get a better handle on your money by signing up for the Moolala newsletter. Super simple to do. You go to moolala.ca and your email address, I promise, will never be used for anything other than to send you a monthly newsletter that includes a whole bunch of stuff from CBC Radio, Sirius XM, BNN Bloomberg, all this show, all that stuff, moolala.ca. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by MNP Debt, specializing in personal bankruptcy, consumer proposals, and debt help. They're Canada's largest consumer insolvency firm, and they've been around for 60 years. 60 years of experience helping Canadians break the cycle of debt. MNP has more than 80 local licensed insolvency trustees serving more than 240 resident satellite offices across the country. Your first step towards a debt-free future, sitting down with one of those folks, one of those licensed insolvency trustees, for a free confidential consultation. MNP Debt, life-changing debt solutions that work. Their website, mnpdebt.ca, mnpdebt.ca. The need for charitable donations these days is huge. You've probably seen the news stories about, you know, food bank usage. You certainly have seen the headlines about what's going on in terms of war and crisis and drought, and all these sorts of things. And many people want to donate money to help. But how do you ensure that you're donating your money in the most effective way possible? There are some strategies. There are certainly some things to think about to make your money go farther when it comes to giving to charity. Craig Switson is a portfolio manager at Lexicon Financial Group at Raymond James Investment Counsel, and he's here to talk about some of those ideas. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
When you think about the effectiveness of donations, we're going to talk about some tactics in a second, but broadly speaking, what does that phrase mean to you, donating effectively?
It's a great question. It means understanding what the cause you're donating to is struggling with or is dealing with at the moment. Do they need money now, for example, for something that's urgent? Do they need money to continue their mission or their vision? Or do they need money for an endowment to put aside for, you know, the future? And so I think it's important that before you make a donation, you understand how that donation is going to be used. And that's the beginning of effectiveness, which is understanding who you're donating to and why you're donating. and what they're going to do with the money that you send their way.
There are so many requests for donations. They come at us from all sides, and well, they should, because, you know, those donations are critical to the operations of many of these charities globally. How do you advise clients to sort through the emails and the ads and the calls from friends and all those sorts of things to narrow it down to causes that are going to be most resonant for them?
Well, it starts with understanding that you are absolutely under no obligation to give. And a simple no or a no thank you may be enough. And if somebody tries to pressure you with some high pressure tactics to donate, it probably means that they're not the right organization for you to be supporting. But more critically, it involves kind of an exercise where you yourself and your family go through and identify the causes that are most important to you. And once you've realized what those causes are, then you can say no to the ones that don't fit inside that strategic framework. So I always encourage people to not give strategically by supporting those causes that you've pre-identified, so that you're not tempted to give to everybody that solicits you for a dollar.
So what do you do when you go to check out at the grocery store? Are you tempted or you graciously decline?
I say no 100% of the time. And it's not that the causes that are being supported aren't valuable. They are. But they number one, they may not be the causes that are most important to me. So I need to figure out if that cause is the most important one to me. And if it is, there are better ways to donate. When you donate at the checkout counter, when you give $2 or when you donate to a GoFundMe, I'm not suggesting that those aren't important causes, but you don't get a donation tax receipt. And receiving a donation tax receipt from a registered charity is a way that you can save money on your income taxes. Everybody likes to save money on your income taxes, but it also means that with that tax savings, you might be able to afford to donate even more to those causes that are most important to you. So the lack of a donation tax receipt for me is something that I'm not maximizing the potential impact I can have on an important cause.
Great segue. You've developed some e-learning that goes through a couple of strategies. First is understanding the donation tax credit. I'm going to ask you to simplify what you take 15 minutes in the e-learning to do. But what are the key things people should know about the donation tax credit?
The first thing is, before you donate, you want to make sure that you are donating to a registered charity. And if you have questions about that, all charities in Canada are registered and information is available on the Canada Revenue Agency site. So it's always a good idea to either ask directly or check yourself. When you receive a donation tax credit, the tax credit depends on your province of residence. And it also depends on your income. But regardless, every dollar that you donate comes with some form of a tax advantage that reduces your overall tax payable. So if you're donating $50, $500, $5,000, that tax credit is something that you can look forward to when you file your income taxes. Everybody sees the little boxes that you have to fill out. When you fill them out, if it's a $20 or a $40 or a $500 tax benefit to you, it's something that the federal government has instituted for a long time to encourage charitable giving.
When you are in a partnership, there can be some advantages in terms of who takes that credit, even if, you know, it comes from the family purse. But sometimes in a couple, one person earns more, one person earns less. Whose tax return should this go on?
Well, the person who has the higher income, who's paying the most in tax.
Yeah, because they'll be in a marginal tax.
Correct. The other thing that's interesting about charitable donations is that they can be carried forward to future years. So if you're making a donation in one calendar year, but you expect to be making more money, more taxable income in subsequent years, you may wish to hold off claiming that donation. That's something people should sit down with their tax accountant and figure out.
The other broad strategy that you developed the e-learning on is the gift of appreciated securities. How does that work?
Well, many people aren't aware that you can donate more than just cash to charities. And one of the things that you can donate is an appreciated security. So imagine you have a stock or a bond in a non-registered or taxable investment account, stock, bond, mutual fund, whatever it happens to be. If that stock has increased in value, if you were to sell that stock, you would realize a capital gain, the difference between what you paid for it and what you sold it for. Capital gains, of course, are subject to taxation. Obviously, they're tax advantaged. They're only taxed at 50%, but they are still taxed. So those, you'd have to claim that on your income tax. If you donate that security to a charity, you will never sell the security. Therefore, you never trigger the capital gain. Therefore, you never pay tax on the capital gain. The tax advantage that accrues to an individual who donates, it really depends on what is the unrealized gain on the security that's being donated and what is your marginal tax bracket. But in all cases, it amounts to something. It is better to donate a security to a charity than it is to sell the same security and donate the cash proceeds.
Does the charity pay that capital gain?
No, charities don't pay the tax on capital gain.
So the government is missing out on tax revenue.
I can't think of a more popular phrase.
You're thrilled. That's amazing.
Look, there's only a couple,
what are the logistics? What are the logistics of that? How hard is that to actually pull off?
It is incredibly easy if you're working with a professional advisor. It is simply, most charities, they will either have it set up with an online donation portal. There are some groups that are intermediaries for the online donation of securities, or it may be as old-fashioned as you fill out a form with your investment advisor or your wealth advisor, specifying which securities you wish to donate, to which charity you wish to donate them, and the back office at the investment dealer will take care of the rest.
So another strategy is to make your donation go further is to be really clear that you're supporting a charity that will make your dollars go as far as possible. There are some questions about how you best determine what effectiveness means, and you know, whether it's a ratio or whether it's your belief in the board, the management. How do you guide people on the effectiveness, how to determine the effectiveness of the charities they choose to support?
It's a great question, Bruce. It's a difficult one to answer because it really starts with what are the causes that you're most passionate about supporting? And it's, if you can identify the causes, whether it's the environment, whether it's education, whatever those causes are, then it's about identifying the charities that you identify the most with. And I would say getting on the phone and asking them some of the difficult questions. Charities have overhead. And one of the challenges in the marketplace right now is that the overhead costs of operating a charity are increasing. It's called inflation. We've all been dealing with it. So have the nonprofits in the charitable sector. But a percentage of the donations have to go to offset the overhead. If the charity you're most passionate about, for example, is into advocacy, most of their costs are going to be overhead. So it's not fair to treat them the same way as you might treat something, like you said in the intro, like a food bank, whose work is a little more in serving the community directly. So I think the best thing is understand what causes you're most passionate about, get on the phone and ask those difficult questions. The other thing I would say is that there's a number of studies out there that the charitable sector, a lot of people think that people who work in the charitable sector should be doing it for free. I disagree. I think that the best charities are going to be the ones that are populated and staffed with the best people. And sometimes that means you have to pay them a little bit more. So I'm not opposed to charities who pay their people, but to get the best talent, because that's the mission we want to advance. I'd rather have qualified people advancing the mission than maybe people who are a little underqualified.
How do you help clients think through what amount, what percentage of assets or what percentage of income they might consider donating? And I know you're going to say it depends, but are there rules of thumb? Are there questions one can ask to provide some guidance here?
Yeah, it depends. No, the reality is that it is different for every client situation. But let's take an average situation. If you're working with somebody who has completed a financial plan and they've included a percentage of charitable giving into that plan, that's one way to absolutely get it. We as a family decide we're going to give X number of dollars a year, and you bake that into your financial plan and your financial projections. If you're talking about maybe people who have a little more wealth, a lot of times what we find is that these would be your top percentile Canadians. They have more money than they will spend for the remainder of their life. The question is, do you leave it to your estate or do you leave it to a charity? You may decide to give it to the charity today while you're still alive. And that's just a question of trying to determine how much money do I require in my investment portfolio to sustain my lifestyle until, kind of the end of my days. So I think the easiest way for Canadians is to set aside a certain amount. This is how much we're going to give to charity on an annual basis and make that a line item in a financial plan.
One last question before we go here. If there was one pitfall when it comes to donating to charity over and above all the stuff that we've talked to today, what would you say the pitfall would be and how do you avoid it?
I think the biggest pitfall for many people is regret. And it's difficult to say that because every charity is deserving of some support. But I find a lot of people will make a donation to a cause that's very important to them today. And then tomorrow that cause isn't so important anymore. And it's not because they don't believe in the first cause. It's that, you said it as well in the intro, life changes. People want to support causes that are important. And over the course of their life, the causes that are important to them also change. And so there are some structures for larger amounts that can avoid some of that regret. But I think it's people saying, you know, I wish I could have done more for this cause instead of the other one. Because once a charitable donation is made, it can't be rescinded. So there's always that, when you're dealing with $50 or $100 donations, the regret is not as acute as it is if you're talking about larger sums of money. But it's overcoming that fear that you might regret your decision down the road.
Really interesting stuff. Craig, thank you for making the time for us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bruce.
Craig Swiston is a portfolio manager at Lexicon Financial Group at Raymond James Investment Counsel. He's developed some e-learning segments on understanding the donation tax credit and on gifting appreciated securities. So do a Google search. You'll find them and you'll find that insight. That's our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you have a comment, a question, a story idea, feedback, anything you want to share, send us an email to ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can sign up for our newsletter at moolala.ca and head on over to the podcast platforms and subscribe to this show. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on X, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.